Yeah, it was a lot of lawyers. It was a big jury verdict. Would you please call our final case?
Our last case today, 822-0037, State of Minnesota versus Comptroller of Washington.
Good morning. Welcome to the Court of Appeals. You may be seated. I know that both of you are experienced appellate lawyers. You know that you can either argue from the podium closest to your table or the middle podium, which goes up and down. You have 15 minutes each. State your name for the record, and appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Spurbeck?
Good morning. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Roy Spurbeck. I'm an attorney with the State Public Defender's Office, and I represent the appellant, Antonio Washington. This appeal presents a single issue related to appellant's conviction and sentence. On November 29th, 2017, police had targeted appellant in a drug investigation. At 10 a.m., appellant left a residence in Eagan, Minnesota, which is in Dakota County. He drove directly to a truck stop outside of Northfield, which is in Rice County. At the truck stop, he sold 12 grams of heroin to an undercover agent. Police, after consummating the sale in the truck stop, believed that they had sufficient evidence to now search the house in Eagan. So they police froze, what I would say in the movies, we'd call freeze the residence. They froze the residence in Eagan, got everybody out of the house, talked to him, and then went and applied for a search warrant in Dakota County. They received the search warrant, and about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, they execute the warrant at the house in Eagan. They find, I think, about 3.8 grams of heroin. That heroin that they find in Dakota County becomes the basis for a charge of second-degree controlled substance offense, possession with intent to sell. That is a charge in Dakota County. In Rice County, the state charges appellant with the first-degree sale of heroin at the truck stop, 12 grams. The Dakota County case proceeds to a jury trial, and as relevant, appellant is sentenced by the court to 141 months on the second-degree controlled substance charge. Appellant then goes back to Rice County. Actually, it's not just back. It takes a little while. Goes back to Rice County and pleads guilty to selling 12 grams of heroin at the truck stop. He is sentenced to 141 months in prison. It is to be concurrent with the Dakota County offense. So the question here, with all those facts in place, is whether this was one offense or a single behavioral incident. I will start with what we, you know, call the single behavioral incident test in Minnesota, applying section 609.035 and 609.04. I know the courts are all familiar with the test. There's about 1,000 published opinions. 900 of them are mine. it involves time, place, and whether or not the offenses are motivated by a single criminal objective.
Which case do you think, of all of those 1,000 cases, is best for you? Is it Kemp?
Well, I sure think Kemp, which I had never seen until I did this case, is super helpful. I think the other cases, when we move into the sort of subparts of the test, there's some older Supreme Court opinions, State versus Bixby and State versus Hedberg, which I think are helpful. I think the case that the trial judge relied to when I went back to make the post-conviction record, Martinez, is quite distinguishable. And I tried to lay out those reasons in the brief, but you know, as we move through the test, you know, if we start with time. And really, you know, time and place are so related, because if you have very disparate places, you know, International Falls in Winona, you're going to have a disparate time also. So there's always going to be some relationship between time and place. And I think the Supreme Court opinions, I mean, Hedberg and Bixby especially, really acknowledge that if we're talking about two different places, we're always going to be talking about two different times. But here, I think what is interesting on the issue of time is when exactly is appellant in possession of the drugs in Dakota County? He leaves that house at 10 o'clock. goes and does the sale in Rice County at 10:30. I would say that he is in constructive possession of those drugs in Dakota County.
The 3.9
up in Dakota County, up until he does that sale in Rice County and is then arrested. He cannot be in constructive possession after that point in Dakota County. He's under arrest. So I really think that is the same time. He is in possession, constructive possession of the drugs in Dakota County at the same time he sells those drugs in Rice County. As part of the post-conviction record, I submitted the jury instructions and closing arguments from the Dakota County case. It is absolutely their theory that he is in constructive possession of those drugs on this date. No other date. The Dakota County prosecution is for constructive possession of that heroin on this day, period.
Oh, November 29, 2017,
exactly.
For both offenses.
Both offenses, you know, the plea and the instruction, the plea in Rice and the instructions in Dakota County, we have pinned down to the same day. Then it becomes a question of, well, within that day, are they close enough in time and place? But for sure, we're going to start in the same day. But I would say that
he pled guilty to actual sale in Rice, and he pled guilty to possession with, or he didn't plead guilty.
Jury found
him guilty,
yes,
of possession with intent to sell. Well, he sold the 12 grams in Rice County. So it wasn't in sale of the 3.9 grams.
The Dakota County chart is, I think of it as, there is about 16 grams of heroin in Dakota County.
Okay.
He takes 12 grams of it to Rice County. He leaves 3.8 behind. Mm-hmm. But the 3.8 left behind is not part of the Rice County sale. They act in Rice County.
Mm-hmm.
I will still say, though, it is part of the same incident because it was all possessed at the same time in Dakota County. He just took some of it to Rice to sell it. So that's where this tension with time and place comes in. So I think what the state has argued is, well, no, Roy, or Mr. Spurbeck, sorry. Mr. Spurbeck, what you're really saying is that it was 10:30 when he did that drug sale in Rice County, but they don't find the drugs for 3.5 hours. However, none of that isn't within appellant's control. He's been arrested. So this time that the state wants to use to get a warrant in the middle of the day in Dakota County and then get their officers together, that's completely within the control of law enforcement. So I'm not sure that 3.5 hours, when you weigh it, should really weigh that heavily against the defendant. First of all, I don't really think it's that in the broad scope of the 609-035 cases, 3.5 hours really isn't that long of a time frame.
But you got 25 miles difference, different counties.
Yeah, well,
I mean, it's not the same amount what is this we're talking about?
Heroin.
I have too many meth cases. It's not the same heroin, right? He's selling a particular bunch of heroin to make money to the undercover officer, and then presumably he's going to sell the rest of it, make it available, barter it, whatever. Wouldn't that say that's two different criminal objectives as well?
Nope, because the... you have to remember that all the heroin is at the same place in Dakota County. The criminal objectives for both offenses is to sell. It is the same criminal objective. There's nothing too broad about it. I mean, I think that's... This is a thing I run into all the time, and I put that footnote in my brief specifically for it. You cannot tie offenses that are disparate in time and place. You can't tie them together with a single objective. That's where you see the cases about your big fraud schemes, and the defendant says, well, I was just trying to steal as much money as I could. And the Supreme Court says, no, because that was January, May, July. You lose the time and place parts of it. This case, the time and place parts are in defendant's favor. The post-conviction court said, these probably are the same criminal objective. I think they have to be. He's selling drugs to gain money. In Rice County, that's exactly what happened. The closing argument in Dakota County from the prosecutor to find him guilty of possession with intent to sell is to point to the money that the police find during the search. Everything is tied together on...
It's not the buy money.
No, not at all. It's just, I think what the Dakota County attorney would say is that that the money they find, in addition to other things they find, shows that he's selling drugs.
Well, let me ask you this. So let's say he had 16 grams of heroin at the start of the day, and the officers, they set up this control buy at Flying J. What if they had set up a controlled buy in Dakota County for the remaining four? And somehow he is able to do both buys.
Yeah.
So two separate sales. So what's your view of whether or not that's...
It'd be the same claim. Let's say it's 2 o'clock.
Yeah, let's say...
10:30 and 2.
It all came out of his bedroom.
It is absolutely... that is, I think, honestly, as strong a single behavioral argument as this. If you look at the Supreme Court cases where they've addressed drug sales under 609.035, they really are looking at cases where the defendant is saying, Monday sale, Wednesday sale, Friday sale. Hey, that's one thing. And the Supreme Court is like, no way. Because you lose the time and the place factors in those cases, and you can't make up the missing time and place by saying, well, I was just doing it to sell money. The closer the sales are, and we got to remember, the second degree charge in Dakota County is a sale. It's just not, I mean, it's possession with intent. It is a sale under the statute. So you still have two sales. So I really think, you know, sale to an undercover agent or possessing with to sell, it's the same thing. It's really about time and place. Now, Judge Bjorkman.
Because it's the same day. If it was the next day, would it
You start to lose the time factor even with a day. But here we're talking about hours.
Right.
Now, I'm sure in the course of my illustrious career, I've tried to tie different days together. It's hard. Okay. But hours.
There is a recording being made of
it. No. Hours, on the other hand, is different because we have these Supreme Court cases that seem to indicate, well, you know, sometimes if it's just hours and two places, we're going to look at it and say one thing, which I think this is what this is closest to. Now, if Judge Bjorkman, if I can turn back to you. So one of the things that's interesting about Kemp is there's a pretty good time gap in Kemp because they have to do that controlled buy. They have to get the drugs back to the St. Paul Police Department. The St. Paul Police Department has to take it to the BCA. BCA has to test it. Then on a Tuesday, I looked up the day of what day of the week it was, and August 14th, 1979, it's Tuesday night. You got to go get a warrant from a judge in Ramsey County.
Show up at the house.
Yeah, I kind of wonder whose house they showed up at. So you go show up at the house, and then you're going to go search it. So we have a pretty good time break in Kemp. Courts are not concerned about the time. Now, I think what the state would say is like, well it's the same place. It's this apartment in St. Paul. I gotta tell you, the fact that If this had all occurred at the house in Dakota County, we'd be talking about one thing under Kemp. But the fact that we have a 25-minute drive, and then all of a sudden everything changes, I don't know that 25-minute drive here, given the time and the criminal objective, governs the case. I don't think it can. Because I think we're really slicing stuff up when we talk about same house 25 minutes away. To the extent we're talking about a different county, I live in a corner of Hennepin County, which I am by car 3 minutes from Ramsey County and 10 minutes from Dakota. We draw some lines to make up counties as jurisdictions in the state. I don't think the fact that it's different counties can drive this either, just because there's a certain arbitrariness to crossing a county line. I will say where I live, I think, provides a good example. So
what's your best argument on the 609.04?
Well, so 609.035 and 609.04 are going to use really the same test. For a second-degree charge is a lesser included of a first-degree charge. It's Kemp. That is really actually that's actually what's happening in Kemp, because the trial judge in Kemp didn't actually sentence on anything but what he considered. He gave a sentence, a very long one, on what he considered the greater offense, which was the sale of the drugs in Kemp. The argument on appeal actually is like, well, you are right not to sentence him, but you actually have to vacate the conviction under 04. So that's actually what's happening in Kemp. So I don't think there's much dispute that a second-degree drug offense is a lesser degree of the same crime of a first-degree drug offense. Real quick on the double jeopardy part of this, I acknowledge that's a much harder argument than the 035 and 04 arguments. If you look back at the Professor Maynard Persig's original comments to 035 and 04, they are to be broader and more defendant-friendly than the Double Jeopardy Clause. You know, if you look at Blockberger, this would actually satisfy part of the Blockberger test because it's a lesser offense. The more difficult part of Blockberger for me is it the same offense? And if you look at Blockberger, it's actually, if you go look at the actual Blockberger, it's actually a drug case. And they are really reluctant to say Blockberger's drug sales are the same thing, even though they look close in time. So I will acknowledge that's a tougher claim. It's still an awesome claim. It's just tougher. So I see my time is up. I would just ask that the post-conviction court's order be reversed and the case be remanded to Rice County for further proceedings.
Thank you. And you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel?
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Sean McCarthy with the Rice County Attorney's Office. I appear today on behalf of respondent, the state of Minnesota. I have to commend Mr. Sperberger. He does a nice job with argument. He's very knowledgeable at this. I don't doubt that he's got his name on all 900 of those cases. The problem we have here, though, is he's focusing in on the appellate's argument, focuses in on this closeness of time, and it's all kind of part of drug dealing. And he didn't have control over when the police did the search or did the arrest. Here's what appellant had control of. He had 15.9, 16 grams of heroin at one location, and appellant made a deal to sell a portion of that to somebody else in a different location. Appellant cut his wholesale stash. If his warehouse is Dakota County Egan, the house he's staying in, that's his warehouse, his wholesale aspect of his business. And then he drove to a remote location 25 miles away in a different county, and in that different place sold the smaller portion, 12 grams, to an individual. He retained, as part of cutting that, he hung on to whatever was left over, the 3.9 grams in Dakota. That's appellant's affirmative choice, affirmative conduct, to break his whole stash into discrete parts for retail sale. And the key here is where 609.035 and 609.4, at root, they're just like double jeopardy in the concept of its proportionality. Is this fair? If think of it this way, if I'm a street drug seller and I've got 5 grams in my pocket, bundled into five separate little packages, ready to make five sales, and I'm walking down the street with all five of them in my pocket, and I sell the first one, and it turns out I sell it to a cop, and that cop busts me for the sale, can they charge me with not only selling the 1 gram, but also possessing the other 4 grams and make that separate crimes? That's the kind of stuff our courts, and Mr. Sperbick has done a nice job of developing the law on this. You got it all on your body, all at the same time and place and location, and it's part of one kind of transaction that's part of your conduct of selling drugs. That seems a little unfair. It goes too far to get them for both the sale and the possession. And indeed, that's the kind of thing, that's exactly what Kemp was. Kemp was a sale in an apartment. The wholesale was also the retail. Mr. Kemp kept everything in the same spot. So when he made a sale in the apartment, and a few hours later, when they do the search of the apartment, they find the extra stuff that he kept behind. That was all in the same place, and he presumably possessed it in that same place at the same time, not unlike the example I gave of the person walking down the street, make a sale of 1 gram while they still got 4 grams in their pocket right then and there. Key here is when you intentionally have your wholesale location and you cut something from that and bring it to a totally different location to sell it to someone other than whoever's around your wholesale place, that's more criminal to me. You're planning ahead. You're planning for future sales, greater culpability.
What case best supports your position, the Martinez case?
Martinez was exactly that. He had a bunch of marijuana in an apartment in Brown County. He put some of that marijuana into a car and drove to Watonwan County. two separate crimes, two separate places, and he cut his wholesale stash, his original amount, into a sub-amount to sell some of it here, presumably to either use, sell, barter, trade, exchange, whatever he wanted to do. A case that I think is useful for the court here, there's an area of sloppiness within this aspect of the double jeopardy 609.04 and 035. The sloppiness comes in exactly what actually Mr. Spurbeck said, and I commend him because he's got it exactly right. The further away you are in place and time, the more distinct the activity is, and therefore you get two separate crimes. The closer in place and time, that's the spectrum we're looking at here. Here we got...
So going back to Martinez...
Oh.
Wasn't there, you know, days between the sale and when the other marijuana was discovered? I mean, maybe I have that wrong, but my memory is there was a bigger difference in time in Martinez and a bigger difference in place, as in this case.
And the key here, that's actually the point I was just about to get to. Where do you draw the line? What's too close, what's too far apart? 25 miles apart where you had to get in the car and drive, not 25 minutes, 25 miles. Those are very distinct, discrete incidents in different places, different times. In Kemp, which is the other side of that spectrum, same apartment. Presumably either in the same room or an adjoining room, you know, that's the nature of apartments. So that closeness in physical location of, again, the retail wholesale analogy I think works well here to address that, because if Martinez had kept all of his marijuana, you know, say he had 200 pounds of marijuana, it was in the trunk, and he sold 50 of it to an officer in the parking lot at a gas station, and then they arrested him for that, and they found the other 150 in the trunk at the same place at the same time, that's clearly closer. So I think the further away you get in distance and time, we don't have these facts in front of us, but to kind of answer the court's question, if the person makes sale number one to person number one, walks 20 feet, makes sale number two to person number two, walks 20 more feet, is that too close or not? I think that's enough to be separate sales. Here, it's you don't have to worry about thinking about is that separate sales or not too much, because here, this is a person who intentionally cut their original amount to a smaller, discrete amount, drove 25 miles down the road to a different place, different location, and in fact, another part of the separatism here is the distinction of the counties and the county lines. I think there is some weight that should be given to that.
Yeah, I've been struggling with what's the importance of that, when you can have a big county where you can drive 25 miles and still be in Hennepin County.
From a criminal procedural standpoint, different judge, different dates, different defense attorney, different prosecutor, different charges. And the important thing here is our Supreme Court has said that in this context where we're analyzing what is a single behavioral incident or not, very important to keep in mind that the elements, if you got overlap, if you need this amount of marijuana plus that other amount of marijuana to get to your higher charge, you can't break it into two different places. That is not the case. I think Judge Riley commented on this earlier, if I remember from one of the questions, that this is not the same heroin. These are discrete, separate amounts of heroin. They might have come from the same place originally. So in that regard, the fact that we have two different amounts in two different counties is the only way you get two different charges. They are completely separate elements. The only commonality is the same defendant did both things. He intentionally held on to some and left it at home, presumably to sell on another day, and took a portion of it to a different location to sell on that day.
So it's the location piece that's the strongest, your strongest argument.
Exactly. And that's the point I'm trying to highlight on. And I don't mean to overemphasize the county lines or boundaries or whatnot. I think, though, that the way it plays out, that when you go to a different location and you knowingly, intentionally have left the drugs behind. Now, if the defendant in this case had taken the full 16 or 15.9 grams, taken it out of his storage spot in Dakota, put it in his vehicle, driven over, got out the scale, and right there in front of the officer, cut it into, here's the 12 I'm selling you, and I'm going to keep the leftovers, that's taking it all with him. That's all one place, one time. So all one place. And matter of fact, counsel referenced the two cases, Bixby and Hegberg, which are referenced in his case as examples where you can have conduct occurring at different locations. It's all one behavioral incident. Those are crim sex cases. Those are cases where the victim was kidnapped, dragged along in a car, molested, raped, physically assaulted in multiple locations. They had the person, they assault them a little bit in one place, they drive, you know, a few miles down the road or an hour down the road and assault the same victim again. See the analogy? It's just like taking the drugs with you. In that case, the methodology or the instrument of the crime was the victim that was being assaulted. If you take that person with you, they're still at the same place and time where you're committing the offense, and the fact that you spread the assaults out over time is less significant. That's the point I'm trying to make here is if you're a drug dealer and you knowingly carve up your drugs into separate discrete amounts to sell in different places at different times, that's more culpable, more criminal, and that's where the proportionality is satisfied. The due process concerns are less concerning there because they've done more egregious stuff. Was there a question?
Yeah. Do you want to address the appellant's pro se supplemental brief, ineffective assistance of counsel?
I thought about addressing it when I was drafting the brief, and it didn't strike me as it centers so much on these underlying arguments. Mm-hmm. And part of the challenge there is it wasn't the same attorneys in the same two counties. It wasn't the same, treated the same, it wasn't analyzed the same because it was two separate offenses. And so I think the flaw in the pro se supplemental is that at its heart, it assumes this is all one offense and anybody should have seen all of that. Now, if they'd had Mr. Spurbeck on the front end, maybe he would have seen that because, you know, he's very familiar with this area of law. But whether or not that rises to the level of ineffective, I think that is difficult to see, especially when you look at the analysis by the post-conviction court. This is the trial court who had one of the cases, had the opportunity to have a developed record, made those specific factual findings. And again, I commend Mr. Spurbeck. This was the right approach here because it would have been a much muddier record without the trial court being able to clarify. This happened here in this location, 25 miles away from this location, and time-wise, we have a 10:26 sale in Rice, and a search warrant signed at 2 p.m. and executed presumably about half an hour later, because that's the difference from the Hastings courthouse to the location in Eagan. 3.5 hour difference. Those kinds of specific facts you don't get unless they're developed somewhere, especially when you have two cases that are charged as two crimes in two counties. Does that answer the question? I'm basically saying I don't think it's worth putting a lot of energy into that piece of it. One last case. It is not directly on point, but I think it goes towards this bigger picture of as the question Judge Cochran asked about what's too close, what's too far away kind of a concept. Fugali, F-U-G-A-L-L-I. It's either two G's or two L's, one or the other. I apologize. I get the guy's name wrong every time. It's a Minnesota Supreme Court case that's cited in the respondent's brief. The focus of that case was on sell and offer to sell, statutory construction. Well, interestingly enough, we're dealing with the same issue here in terms of when you're interpreting the drug statute, we want to make sure we're interpreting it broadly to catch as much criminal conduct as possible. Mr. Fugali offered to sell 10 grams. He actually only delivered 7.9 or something like that, less than that. And the court said, nope, even though you didn't physically deliver as much, you offered that much, and offer to sell is the same thing as sell. And the key here is the court focused in on the fact that, or our Supreme Court focused in, that in the context of drug crimes, we want to intentionally interpret those statutes broadly because of the drug crimes are some of our most serious crimes. The reason the Drug Task Force in this case focused in on Mr. Washington, the case before this panel, is because he was the number one heroin seller. And heroin plus heroin mixed with fentanyl, the Fugali was a fentanyl mix, people were dying. That's why they were trying to get the bigger sellers in this area to protect public safety. That fits in, I think, here with how close is too close, how broad, and how many, where are we going to split the hairs on this? In the context of drug activity under 152, we're supposed to interpret the statutes and apply the statutes in the way that is remedial, that protects the public. And again, I'm not going to try to say that Fugali says all of exactly that. I'm saying there's a way to fit those pieces together. And one thing this panel can do is, I don't know that you need a published decision on this. It's a pretty well-established area of law. It's driven largely by the factual findings that the trial court already made. 25 miles apart, 2.5 to 3.5 hours apart, depending on how you interpret the search warrant details of it. But that's enough for you to rule on it here. But you could clarify exactly the concept that Mr. Spurbeck and I agree about. The further away they are in place and time, the more discrete and separate those actions are, those incidents are. And the closer they are in place and time, and especially if you brought all of this stuff with you and had it in the car or on your person, had the victim that you kept assaulting over and over again with you, that's the kind of scenario where you can't double dip, you can't double punish. But when you intentionally carve out some of it to take and sell in one place and leave the rest behind, so that you got it available to sell the next day or the next afternoon or maybe that same morning if you're having a busy retail day. The problem there is that's more criminally culpable, and it's okay to add more punishment for that. Unless the panel has other questions, I'll wrap up at this. Well, I've got 6 seconds, I guess.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks. And thank you, Mr. Spurbeck.
Rebuttal?
Yeah, sure. You know, it's kind of interesting pieces here. You know, the idea of the defendant breaks it up into discrete parts, that's actually Kemp, right? Sell some, keep some. You know, all you have then in that case is that it's the same apartment in St. Paul. But you're clearly breaking up what is a larger amount. You know, if this case involved the police searching the house in Dakota County and finding the 16 grams, it's going to be one charge. It's not going to be two charges because you found it all in the same place at the same time. And if you did try to charge two offenses and then the defendant was convicted of them, under this court's very clear case law, you're only going to get one sentence, maybe only one conviction. So I don't know that breaking it up matters as much as the state wants to think it matters, because those are actually Kemp's facts. State versus Martinez, the opinion, it is different days, because the drugs in the storage locker, the opinion says that the evidence showed he had them for several days there. He is then caught with drugs in a car in Wanton. So I think you have a different time frame. You also, and this drives the court's opinion, you have different objectives, because they're going to say the Brown County case, and I might mix up which is which, but one is a possession case and one is clearly a sale case. Those are different criminal objectives. It also, all that part of the opinion is dicta, because the first part of the opinion rejects that 609.035 applies at all. So I think Martinez, and I laid all this out in the brief, I think Martinez is of limited utility, actually. One of the things that's interesting about this idea of the street-level drug dealer, so sells, makes one sale, walks down the street, makes a second sale, makes a third sale. In my experience, very often what a prosecutor would do in that case is aggregate the sale amounts. So it's not going to be, unless the sales are just tiny amounts, they're going to add those quantities together to get a more serious charge. So one of the things that the legislature has given prosecutors in these cases is the ability to pull together small amounts into a single large amount for a more serious charge. That is a way that the legislature has, I think, quietly cut against an 035 and 04 analysis in these cases, because it gives the prosecutor another tool to work around what might otherwise look like a single incident, three very close sales. Well, depending on the amounts, maybe you push them together and make a more serious offense. The last thing I just wanted to touch on, and maybe it's obvious from the briefing, if you were to decide in appellant's favor in this case, and it really wouldn't matter which remedy it was, he's going to have a 141-month prison sentence. It's either going to be the Dakota County one or the Rice County one. So he's going to be in prison. It's just on which one it is. And so I know there's probably some wheels spinning saying, why are you here? Because it is important to have accurate criminal histories. and it's important to have sentencing that is accurate. The Supreme Court, Minnesota Supreme Court, has said on multiple occasions that sentencing in this state is a matter of very important public policy. It is important that the defendant's sentence, and thereby, and from there, his criminal record is correct. So that's really at the end here. He's going to be in prison for 141 months on one of these charges. In his favor, his record will look a tiny bit better. Thank you.
Thank you. That concludes our oral calendar, and it was good to go out on this one. It was interesting.